I mean, it's the, in our, you know, our generation, we'll never have to go to war or anything like that as men. I feel like apart from going to war, I don't, can't even imagine anything as hard as this. Like, it's kind of, like, nothing has demanded resilience more than being a parent, because it is relentless and you're constantly coping with challenges. You're constantly dealing with problems and it's relentless. You go to sleep and then it's not like I'll wake up in the morning fresh and I'll go again. It's like you go to bed and you're probably woken up at one and then at three and then at five and be tested again and again and again. So it is relentless.
Hello and welcome to The Dad Train, where we explore ideas and strategies on how to be a better man, a better partner, and a better dad. I'm your host, Scott Davison. I hope you enjoy this episode and learn something new. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Dad Train. Well, I'm pretty excited about today's interview. This is someone I've been following for a long time now and someone whose work I really admire. I'm talking with Hugh van Kylenburg from the Resilience Project. Now, most of you are probably familiar with Hugh's story. He started the Resilience Project about 10 years ago, and they've now reached over 1 million Australians through their schools program, the corporate talks, and well, pre-COVID anyway, Hugh was travelling around the country presenting to sellout crowds, basically telling his story. And it's an amazing story. It delivers a really simple but important message about mental health and in particular the importance of gratitude, empathy and mindfulness. Now, Hugh is also a father with two young kids, so I'm keen to have a chat to him about that as well. Okay then, let's get into it. Hugh van Kylenburg, welcome to the Dad Train.
It's a pleasure to be on. It's a I tell you, my this could, I know I've only got like 45 minutes, but the topic of being a dad, I could talk all day on this, and I do love this, and I do love this podcast as well, Scotty. The as a huge Melbourne Tigers fan, any podcast of Chris Anstey on, that gets me very excited.
That got your attention. I know you do a lot of podcasts, including your own one, which is The Imperfects, and that's top of the charts. So I do appreciate you sort of finding the time to come on my humble little dad podcast.
It's a very important podcast you do. And like, you've had some incredible guests on and feel a little bit out of my depth when I see the people you've had on, but I'm excited to be here because Chris Anstey's been on this. And if Chris Anstey ever listens to this episode, then I'll be very happy.
He'll be glad to hear that. Yeah, it's been interesting. I've been able to get some guests. And I think it's funny, you know, like I was thinking about this the other day. It's probably half the male population that are in this club. But once you become a dad, it feels like you're sort of joining this exclusive brotherhood. And I've been able to sort of reach out to other dads and they've been very keen to get involved. Have you found that since you became a dad? Is it sort of, have you felt you're part of a club all of a sudden?
Yes, I absolutely do. I'll give you an example from the other day. I was, I bravely decided, I shouldn't say bravely, my wife does this every day, but I decided to take my 10-month-old out for a walk with my 3.5-year-old and the dog as well. And I had Elsie, my 10-month-old, on my chest. I had Benji sitting there next to me and the dog on a lead. And we'd stopped outside a cafe and I was giving him, they've got these at our local cafe, those really good sugar-free gingerbread men. So I feel like I can always get him one of those, just not full of sugar. I gave it to him and he went to bite it and one of the legs came off the gingerbread man and hit the ground.
Oh no.
And the performance from him, he was just so angry at me, at everything that half his gingerbread. And this dad walked past. Well, I know he's a dad. He walked past. He gave me the most empathetic look I've ever seen. and he said it was about probably, I can't remember what, it was in the afternoon, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon or something. And he said, yes, hang in there, mate, 3 hours to go. Which is exactly what it was, because it was 3 hours until we put him into bed. So there's no way that bloke and I would have had a conversation. If he wasn't a dad and he walked past, he wouldn't probably even noticed. But he even, not that he noticed, but he just time checked it for me. Let me know how long of this mayhem I had to go. Yeah, so absolutely, it is a brotherhood. It changes everything. But one of the things is I feel very connected to other dads who walk around looking like zombies, who are just so tired.
And so Benji, what's he's in prime tantrum age at the moment, is he?
Oh my gosh. Mm. He's turning 4 in a couple of weeks. And my wife and I had been told about the terrible twos, and we braced ourselves for terrible twos. In fact, we high fived each other on his third birthday and thought, thank goodness that's over. But no one told us that Evan's gonna turn 4. My God, I have never in my life they turned 3. I don't know if there's a name for the
three nages is what they're called.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well that's very good. That's exactly what he is. And although I feel like it's more like psychopathic threes or something. But anyway, he's a beautiful kid and I couldn't love him more. And he gives us these incredible moments of, you know, where he's just, you can see the adult or the boy or the teenager he's gonna be, I hope.
Yeah.
But then, you know, something very small will go wrong. What was it this morning? The tantrum we had this morning we'd had a really nice morning. I was up with him from about 6:15 and my wife slept in this morning. When I say sleep in, she was up at 8. But she came downstairs and what had happened? It was the smallest event and it just triggered him and he completely lost his marbles for about half an hour and ruined the morning basically. But yeah.
So that's that knowing look you got from the other dad, as you say, the empathy that you can have for other parents who've been through it or who are going through it.
Totally. Because you know how hard it is. That's the hardest thing for me. Like, it's the hardest thing I've ever, I mean, it's the, in our, you know, our generation, we'll never have to go to war or anything like that as men. I feel like apart from going to war, can't even imagine anything as hard as this. Like, it's kind of, nothing does that demanded resilience more than being a parent, because it is relentless and you're constantly coping with challenges. You're constantly dealing with problems and it's relentless. You go to sleep and then it's not like I'll wake up in the morning fresh and I'll go again. It's like you go to bed and you're probably woken up at 1 and then at 3 and then at 5 and be tested again and again and again. So it is relentless, and my wife is doing an unbelievable job.
Yeah, a good test of resilience, as you said. Has it given you a bit more of appreciation for your own parents?
Yeah, so there's a few things on that, and it's a really lovely question. It absolutely has. I mean, the two things, I remember when my son was about probably 3 months old and I was looking at him and I was with mum and I had this moment of thinking, oh my gosh, you love me as much as I love Benji. I didn't know you loved me that much. Like, I knew, I didn't say this to mum, but in my head I'm like, I knew you loved me, but I didn't know it was that much. Like, wow, gave me an appreciation of that. And then on top of that, I think it gave me an appreciation of dad was a dentist and very hardworking. And I think I'm right in saying this, he missed one day in 44 years. And I remember thinking, God, why would you work that hard? Like, but I realize now he did that for us. Like, he didn't like being a dentist. He hated it by the end. It was awful. He was just, but he did it for us. And then my mum, on the other hand, she stopped working and was a stay-at-home mum for 3 kids. I'm a working dad of 2 kids, and that is hard enough for me. So what my mum did, you know, because she believed that was, and not everyone has the luxury of being able to do that, and I get that and I acknowledge that. But mum could have very easily kept working and put us into, her belief was that being at home with us as much as possible was the best thing for us. And so she made that sacrifice and stayed at home for, I think it was 15 years really, with the 3 of us. So my dad came over this morning and our relationship's changed completely. It's like, usually when dad came over, it was like, we'd talk about cricket, we'd talk about athletics, we'd talk like, and he would ask me about my running and what I thought of the cricket and all that kind of stuff. Now it's like, he comes over and we just focus on my kids, and it's just really nice. I really enjoy it. I really enjoy the change of dynamics in our relationship. It's I don't know, it's a hard one to explain, but I think anyone who's lucky enough to have their parents still alive to be grandparents to their kids probably know that feeling of like, you both sharing the love of these kids you've created. That's pretty special.
Yeah, and it's a whole another experience for the grandparents, isn't it? They get to go again, but it's a completely different experience, and you can see the joy they get from it.
All care, no responsibility, isn't it? Like, they can come over and whip him into a frenzy and then go.
But it sounds like your dad's done his time. I wanted to ask about your dad, because you do tell one story in your book about a lesson in resilience that your dad gave you while playing cricket in the backyard. But do you remember other things that you've learnt from your dad over the years?
Yeah, it's funny you ask this because we're just starting work on the second book right now, and I, without deliberately meaning it, I've realised my dad's much more. He features a lot more in this one, and he wasn't left out deliberately in the first one. It's just my sister's story kind of dominated, but so much for my dad. I mean, my dad, you know, the more I see a psychologist every couple of weeks, I remember sitting down with her at the start of the year and saying, look, I don't have a mental illness, so I don't think I'll need to see you regularly, but maybe once a month I'd love to chat through stuff. And said, yeah, it's fine. I've seen her every second week the whole year. And she said to me last week, she said, oh, so I'll be away for a couple of weeks. I went, whoa, sorry. When are you going away? I didn't know about this. Can I still call you? What's the, we have been sort of unpacking my dad's journey a little bit. And my dad came to Australia when he was 10 years old, a Sri Lankan, born and bred in Sri Lanka, Sri Lankan parents. I don't look anything like my dad. I mean, I kind of do. We've got very different skin color though, but, and so when dad first came to Australia, this is back in 1960s, I think, as a Sri Lankan boy who's never left Sri Lanka before. It was a really tough experience, and he was subject to a lot of awful racial stuff. Mm. Won't do me any good talking about what it was, but he had some awful experiences, both physically and mentally for looking very different. So that's always had a big impact on me, and that I've always been, you know, like I have a very strong social awareness on racial equality because of what happened to my dad when he first came out here and his brother. I mean, when my dad was on the boat on the way out to Australia, he wasn't allowed on the deck of the boat because they were worried his skin would get too dark, and with the white Australia policy, he wouldn't get in. Yep. So he's a bit darker than the rest of his family. So my dad is a boat person, essentially. So I think it shaped a lot of my views politically, my dad's experience. But then as a person, my dad, you know, I've never met innocent. I feel like that people think that in a bad way. I met it in such a good way. The sweetest, most innocent, loving, loyal. My God, he's so loyal, hardworking person. Like he just, when he first came out to Australia, apparently he went to Melbourne High School, and the reason his parents came out here was to give him and his brother opportunities that didn't exist in Sri Lanka. And it wasn't safe in Sri Lanka with the civil war. So he felt enormous responsibility as the oldest brother to live up to what his parents had, you know, that had changed their life completely for him. So he worked so unbelievably hard. Mum tells me a story that they met when they're at school, mum and dad, and apparently dad would study he'd get home at 4 o'clock, he'd start studying, and he would study until 10 o'clock every single night, and he would put 10 minutes aside to chat to mum on the phone. That was it. And because he felt the pressure to do really well, and he did do really well. So I don't know if it's had a huge impact on me as far as making me a hard worker. I don't work anywhere near as hard as my dad, but I certainly admire that in him, and his sort of understand his motivation for it. And he's just a lovely, lovely person. Like I heard a story about dad that I still can't make you laugh every single time I hear this. But when dad was dad was a very, very good cricketer. He played cricket, Premier League cricket, district cricket in Victoria for Peran and Melbourne University. And he was on the verge of state selection for a little while, didn't quite get there. And when he was playing against an Australian player, and I won't say the person's name because he won't have the opportunity to defend himself here, but he was playing against an Australian player who called him a black sea. He said, "You are a black sea," when dad was batting. And this guy's playing for Australia at the time. That hurt dad because he looked up to this bloke, or he did until that point. And I said to dad, "That's awful." And dad said, "Oh, I got him back. Don't worry, I got him back." I said, "Oh, what?" And I'm thinking, I can't imagine dad getting revenge on me. When that doesn't sound like dad. I said, "What'd you do?" And he said, "Well, I walked past him." I said, "Hey," he said, I walked up and said, "Hey, poop you." Whoa, you really got him.
Actual poop. You're not softening that for the podcast. He said
poop you. That was he doesn't swear, dad. But he's such a good, you know, and he's so my dad is a lovely person. And I would when I was playing cricket, when I was very young, playing Premier Cricket in Victoria when I was 17, 18, I'd come up against players, much older guys who had actually played against Dad when they're young. So guys maybe in their late, mid-30s who when they were really young, played against Dad. And they'd always would comment that I was nothing like Dad when I was playing cricket against him because I was, Dad telling me stories of what people used to say and do to him. I was like, I'm never letting someone talk to me like that. And I always felt like this, like, not as in like, I don't want to be like Dad. I didn't feel that. I felt like I had to, I felt like I was retaliating on behalf of Dad. So these people who, like, you know, who didn't, one of these guys, like, he would have been 37, 38, and I came out to that and he said something to me, and it was something like, it wasn't pleasant, and I knew he would have played against Dad, and I gave him the biggest mouthful of abuse, and it went on and on and on. I was like, well, no, I'm sorry, but this is, in my head, I'm like, this is from Dad, because you're probably nasty to Dad as well.
Here's one from me, and here's one from Dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is from me, this is from Dad, even though the guy probably never doesn't even remember Dad. But anyway, Dad's like had an unbelievable influence on me, and the story in the book isn't overly reflective of Dad. It's for those of you who haven't read the book. We were playing cricket and I had a hissy fit when I was about 5 because he ran me out. And he just said to me, if you ever do that again, I'm not going to play cricket with you ever again. Simple as that. And from that point, I remember going, okay, like, that's unacceptable, because my dad never really got cross ever. And so for him to do that, I thought, oh, what I've done is really bad. And I'll never forget that. But he never really got that cross us as kids. It was more the not angry, disappointed type style, which has a big impact on you, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I didn't know your dad was Jamaican. That explains a few things. It explains your love of cricket, clearly, but it doesn't explain your surname. And I always assumed it was perhaps a Dutch background or something. But
well, it is. The Dutch Burgers. There's a group of Sri Lankans called Burgers from Portuguese. So when would it be? I don't know the exact year. My Sri Lankan history is not as good as it should be, but. There's a lot of, amazingly, whenever I go to Sri Lanka and you go into different, I played cricket over in Sri Lanka, and I remember going into a dressing room and they had the honour boards up there, and in the honour boards, in the middle of a candy in this small cricket club, there was, I counted 3 Van Kylenbergs on there. So Van Kylenberg is a common name in Sri Lanka.
Interesting.
Yeah, so Burgers. There's a lot of, all Sri Lankan people know of Burgers, and that's us. We're the
Burgers.
Known as the Burgers, yeah.
Cool. Look, it's amazing you've got such a close relationship with your dad, and as you say, it's evolved since you've become fathers, and you've sort of got that in common now, but a lot of men don't have that relationship with their dad, and it can often come through in the way they parent, either in positive or negative ways. So, you know, in your case, you've had a positive role model, but you know, sometimes people have had negative role models, and they're sort of taking from that how they don't want to be, I guess. So there's lessons to be learned from whatever example you had, but it sounds like you had a great one in your dad.
Yeah, I did. It's really interesting you say that. I have been thinking a lot about, I keep thinking to myself, I've got to model really good behaviours to Benji. And Elsie, I've got to make sure I'm really modelling, you know, the way to behave and the way to act and all that. But I think from a lot of what I'm reading, a lot of the way we behave is kind of the opposite of our parents. And certain things we don't like, we will make sure we are never like that. And I think that explains why a very, very dear friend of mine, his dad, I suppose, kind of took, for want of a better term, he took off when he was quite young, and disappeared, and his dad wasn't part of his life. And he is, you know, the complete opposite of that. He is the most committed, loyal, present father. He shows up, he's there all the time, he's giving it all. And that's because he's thinking, well, I'm not going to, you know, I think some men might follow in their dad's footsteps in that way and have those characteristics. Others go, nah, I'm not.
Yeah,
putting my partner through what my mom went through. Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we had this session with a group of psychologists the other day it was a workshop we were doing with the Resilience Project, and you had to talk about different characteristics in yourself that you see in your parents and different characters you didn't like. And I remember one of the psychologists said, I said, what explains this? And she said, oh, well, many of us will go the opposite. So the thing we find most frustrating about our mum, we will go the absolute opposite with, which makes you think, yeah, we've got to model the right behaviours, but it doesn't necessarily mean the kids are going to turn out a certain way.
No, that's right. I mean, they've all got their own personalities anyway, and yeah, you're modelling something, but that's not necessarily what they need to copy. It's just a good example for them. I'm thinking of that. Like, I know obviously there's a lot to the Resilience Project message, but these three-word acronym that you use, GEM, so gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness, they're sort of the key messages from your experience. What, with yourself, first of all, is there one of those that perhaps comes naturally to you that you're stronger with and one you sort of struggle with a bit more? And also, are you seeing that in your kids?
So gratitude has always come very, very naturally to me. I have always – my mum told a story at my wedding in April last year that my bedroom growing up as a kid was – what way did it face? It would have faced east. Is that right? Yeah, east. So the sun would sort of come up and there was a garage from the neighbour's house right next to my room. But there was a small window of probably about half an hour where the sun would come into my room. And it was around the time that I'd wake up. And we had – there was a jasmine bush down the side of the house. And mum would come into my room when I was, I don't know, 5 or 6 or whatever, very young in primary school. And she'd open up my window as a way of sort of gently, you know, waking me up. And apparently I'd always go, "Mum, how good is this sun on my face and I can smell jasmine?" And I don't remember that story at all, but I do remember loving – I still love the smell of jasmine. But she said you always – made sure you would pay attention to the good stuff as it was happening. And you would often say, "How good is this?" when we were doing things. So that's not my words. I'm not saying, yes, I was very grateful, but according to my mum, I was. I feel empathy is something that can't explain why, but I've certainly always felt that a lot of my life. And last night I watched a show on 7:30, the 7:30 report, and it was on a man called Mick, an Indigenous man. I don't know if you saw it, no. Scott. He was part of the stolen generation, taken from his parents when he was 5 years old, sent to an institution when he was let out when he was 15 with nowhere to go. He had to steal to, you know, to feed himself, and he got put in prison age 15, and he's now 59, I think it was, or 60, and he's still waiting for a commissioning flat to live in. They still haven't found him one, and I couldn't sleep last night. I couldn't stop thinking... I mean, that is just the most awful thing that the Australian government back then decided to take kids away from their parents. Empathy is when you feel what someone else feels. Like 4 years ago, I would have thought about it from his point of view and thought, I mean, I did think about it from his point of view, but more so I don't think that poor bloke being told. But last I was thinking, imagine someone took our kids away, like just came and took them away and said, "It's in the best interest of the country. You'll never see your kids again. We're taking him to bring out the way we for you." Like you don't recover from that. Like you just simply don't. And so, and then to apologise to him and not be able to get him somewhere to live because, like, the government destroyed this man's life. And so I couldn't stop thinking about that last night. So I feel like empathy is probably something that it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes it's good for you, but then it also can, you know, I couldn't sleep because of it last night. But mindfulness is one that I do battle with a lot because I feel like having never experienced anxiety or depression, or I've always felt a very happy person. I haven't really felt a very big need to stop and meditate every single day. And a lot of the people I listen to who talk about it just so desperately needed it in their life because of, you know, a healthy way of sort of dealing with stuff they've been through. And I was listening to Sam Harris 2 nights ago, a neuroscientist, talk about his experience with it, and it seemed like it came from a place of he really needed to discover something. So I often, but having become a parent, I've found myself being a lot more stressed than I ever have before, and I've noticed that I'm now finding time to make sure I'm living a lot more mindfully, I guess. But yeah, that's the one that doesn't come naturally to me because I think you have to practice that to be good at it. And it's one that I always feel quite happy. I don't feel like, God, I've got to do meditation so I can feel good again. But it's one I need to work on more for sure.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's the one I struggle with. I think it's funny because often you look at young kids and they're very mindful. They're totally in the moment. It seems to be as we get older and busier and we get more in our head, and that's one I struggle with as well, particularly after becoming a father and you're playing with your kids and you want to sort of be as present as you can and your mind's off wandering, thinking about work or other things. So it does take bit of practice there, but
it sure does.
Yeah, but I share what you're saying about gratitude. I think that was one I always felt quite natural with as well, and I think it actually came from my father. He was he was a lot like remember Daryl Kerrigan from the Castle. We would sit down
lucky
for
person.
Dinner. Yeah, exactly. Mum would serve up rissoles and he'd be carrying on like it was a Michelin star meal. So I think that was drummed into me from a young age.
Oh, what a fantastic role model that is. I just love that. I mean, there's no better picture of gratitude than Daryl Kerrigan sitting around his dinner table. I don't think so. You're very lucky to have that as a role model.
Yeah. And what about with your kids? I know they're still young, but are you noticing that they have particular strengths in any of those areas?
I can't really comment on Elsie yet, being 10 months old. She certainly smiles a lot and seems to, she adores her big brother. She absolutely adores him and he adores her. So in the morning, he'll usually wake up before her and he'll come into our bed. And as soon as we hear her get up, he'll say, "Can I open it or can I?" But he loves being the one that she sees first in the morning. So he'll go and open the door and she'll see it and a big smile on her face, which is lovely. I mean, he's a really interesting one. I mean, he's got a few issues with anxiety, social anxiety, which we're kind of working away at with the help of some very good people. I'm trying to practice gratitude with him. So we, every night before bed, I'll say, "What was your favourite thing that happened today?" Last night is really good. Last night he said it was seeing my friends, Margot, Jemima and Ivy. But other days he will just get angry when I ask him. So I certainly don't force it on him, but I do ask the question every single night. If he doesn't want to answer, that's fine. But he's very present. That's one thing for sure. Like he takes, as you said before, but he doesn't miss a thing. Like we're 400 metres from a train station. If he hears a train going past, he always goes toot toot. And I always think, what? Oh, yeah, there's a train here. You're right. Or if he hears a plane, he hears a helicopter. He just notices everything that's happening as it's happening, or different birds and. He's really present and empathetic. Yeah, I much to my, I wouldn't say relief, but I was just really happy that the other day he, what happened? He was, that's right. He was playing with Elsie and she bumped his head accidentally and hurt him a little bit, but not much. And he got angry and he gave her like a headbutt back a little bit harder than she did, and it really upset her and she cried, and he cried for twice as long as she did and twice as loud, and it was purely just he was so upset he'd hurt her. And I remember thinking, well, that's good. that's good that you didn't enjoy hurting her. You actually you couldn't, it's very obvious you are feeling exactly what she's feeling right now. So you know that. So I think that is I think it has come through in that empathy, which is really nice.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And what about other kids? Because, like, I know your background's in teaching, right? And you've done a lot of work. Originally, Resilience Project was very much about the schools program. So out there with kids today, are you seeing these three themes sort of, are they issues for kids of different ages? What are some of the trends you're seeing?
Well, I can tell you what the research is saying, actually. The research that we've actually had done on our program. So we had, who was it? We had research done over the last, I'm just looking up here on my phone just to check. We did research. Well, Melbourne University ran a research program on us, a 3-year evaluation, comprehensive. And I was really nervous about it at first because I thought we don't have to do this because the program's incredibly popular. We don't need it to prove that what we're doing is working because we're so busy. But then I thought, I think we do need to actually make ourselves vulnerable and practice what we preach and find out what we're not doing well. That's the whole point of it, really. And what we found was that in the schools we worked with, we found huge improvements in gratitude when we worked with the school. So the kids become a lot more grateful, a lot more, which was really exciting to find out. Empathy was the fascinating one. When they did the pre-trials or the pre-research on the kids before the before our program, it was at a ceiling level. Like, it couldn't have been any higher already, the levels of empathy. So when, so luckily we didn't, our program didn't decrease empathy. It didn't get backwards. It stayed the same. And mindfulness had actually said that they couldn't prove that what we'd done had made a difference in the kids, which at first I was devastated about. I thought, well, no, that's the whole point of doing this. Like, we need to change the way we're teaching mindfulness because we haven't quite had the impact we thought we had. So to answer your question there, mindfulness, we couldn't prove. Gratitude, it seemed like it was a new concept to the kids, and we were able to help them with that. Yep. Empathy through the roof, which was really lovely.
Yeah, and gratitude. So that what's the exercises you're doing here? Is it sort of the jotting down things and reminding what we're grateful for? So how do you do that with kids, and how could dads apply that at home?
With gratitude, sorry, just cut out then.
With gratitude in particular, which is the one.
Yeah, very simply, just get kids to record three things that went well for them during the day. Not three amazing things, not three extraordinary things, and not three things they're grateful for, actually. It's just three things went well for them.
Yep. And what's it about there? It's just sort of focusing the mind on those things. Is it this sort of kids are a bit negative, or what's it countering?
No, it's not that they're negative. It's getting them to all of us have this we're all hardwired to pay attention to the negative. That's kind of a survival thing from like neurologically, we're sort of hardwired to just from the caveman days, if there's a rustling in the bush, you've got to check a sort of saber-toothed tiger or whatever. It's a survival thing. But we don't have the same threats in our lives anymore, but our brains still constantly look out for threats. And because of that, we pay attention to the negative. We soak in the negative. We're seduced by a negative. They're actually threats to our ego now, not threats to our lives, and we pay way too much attention to them. This activity of writing down three things went well, it's about rewiring your brain to pay attention to the positives, which is really, really... What I love about it is it's so easy to do, Scott. Like, it takes kids 2 minutes and they enjoy it, which is why it's really good.
Yeah, it's an easy exercise for kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And how's the school's program going? And I guess what else are you sort of up to at the moment with the Resilience Project?
I mean, when I started this back 10 years ago, the program was me doing a speech to the kids every year level at the school. And it's evolved now to this. I mean, we don't just do one-off talks anymore. We've decided that we're not there to go in, wow the kids, and then leave. Like, if you want to have an impact on a school community, first of all, you need to work with all three groups, parents, teachers, and kids, and it needs to be ongoing. It can't just be a one-off program that lasts a week. It's got to be, so we now have curriculum, and we also measure the kids before and after. We measure their levels of wellbeing. And so with that, we are restricted to how many schools. Well, previously, we were restricted to how many schools you can work with. So it used to be, now we call it a partnership program. So if you're a partner with the Resilience Project, you are getting a lot of things. You're getting a wellbeing survey before and after. You're getting teacher training, student sessions, a parent session, curriculum for the kids, lessons for your teachers on how to teach the curriculum, ongoing support with one of our staff, and it goes for the year. And I think we've got 380 partnership schools next year. We have 50 kindergartens working with us. We've got a kindergarten program as well now, and we've got 120 digital programs happening next year. So 120 schools, we're not going to visit them. They've got all our content on video, which we've spent the last 2 years developing. And my younger brother, Josh, is a videographer. He's created that product, and it's I'm extremely proud of it. It's very, very good. So schools can now, from anywhere in Australia, we're not limited by geography. We're not limited by time. They just get online, click, purchase the digital program, and they get everything they need, plus the curriculum. So I think all up next year, it's around about 500 schools.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, I think a lot of people look at the Resilience Project and think, oh, it's an overnight success. It seems to have appeared from nowhere. But, of course, once you read the book and learn a bit more about it, it's more like a 10-year overnight success. But to be growing still and reaching that many schools, that's incredible. You must be really proud of that.
Yeah, I really can't believe where we're at now. Like, sort of pinch myself just hearing, like, you know, I drove past a school in about an hour west of Townsville last year, just doing some work. There's a big sign at the front saying Resilience Project coming next year. And I was like, God, I just can't believe that the reach we've got all of a sudden and the impact we're having. It's an incredible feeling. And to think back to, I remember sitting down, working out in my, just in a notepad, that if I could work with, if I do an hour presentation, I could charge $350 an hour maybe to do a presentation. This is back in 2010. I was thinking, if I did like four of those a week, then that could maybe help me get to like just below a teacher. So that's all I need. That's fine. But it relied on me going to a different school every single day of the year, which I ended up doing two or three schools a day every day. And it was so exhausting. And I remember collapsing on stage about 5 years ago. I was so exhausted. Mm. And now to sit here and see that I'm going to speak at 10 schools in total next year, but we're reaching 500 schools.
Yep.
And that's not because of me. That's because of our Ben Waterman, our general manager or CEO next year, has just created this monster of a product that just is so scalable and reaches anyone, anywhere, which is lovely.
That's amazing. It's amazing. And what else is going on with the Resilience Project? So you mentioned your brother there. He helps with the podcast as well, does he?
He does, yeah. He's sort of he started off as our producer, and now he's got himself a microphone. So he's very much a part of that now. So yeah. The podcast is another product that I love, because I'm getting messages from people who have said they were listening to it and realized 5 or 6 episodes in it was helping their mental health. But if someone had said to them, listen to this mental health podcast, they said, there's no bloody way I'd be doing that. But you sort of caught me off guard and sort of snuck in, and all of a sudden I'm taking all these steps to improve my mental health. So that's really nice.
Well, it's almost a comedy podcast. I mean, I have to admit, I'd never come across Ryan Sheldon previously, but he's hilarious. And his input on the podcast means it's kind of like listening to a comedy with a hidden message underneath it,
which is the best feedback we could have ever asked for. I think, Ryan, it took me 10 months to convince him he should be on it. He wanted to produce, he wanted to be part of it, but he didn't understand what role he could play. And he kept saying, I'm not qualified to be in the room with you talking about this stuff. And I kept saying, no, but like, you'll make it more listenable. If it's more listenable, more people will listen and will reach. And he's saying, no, I don't think I will. And after 10 months, he agreed to do it. And he's just, I mean, there are a lot of podcasts out there on mental health, and a lot of podcasts out there on, resilience and depression, anxiety kind of stuff. And I was looking up the other day, I was so excited about how many there are. Beyond Blue have got them, and, all these Smiling Mind, they've all got their podcasts, which is great. And I was looking at, I was thinking, God, I hope they've got a big reach, because the more people listen to this stuff. And I was looking at it, and I thought, God, we've got a lot of listeners. And that comes down to Ryan. Like, you listen to it because it's really funny, and there's a powerful message as well. It's like, I think if it wasn't funny, I don't think there'd be anywhere near as many people tuning into it. So I think he plays an unbelievable role, and he doesn't realize it, but he really does.
Yeah, no, he's a very funny man. I really like his style of humour. It's
it's terrific, isn't it?
Yeah. So you were saying there that I just lost my train of thought. Sorry, Hugh.
No, that's right. Well, I didn't really answer your question, but apart from that, what's on the horizon for us is the Kinder program, which starts next year, which is very exciting. We have a program starting in New Zealand, in the UK. We have a few schools in New York, which I'd love, because I'd love to get to New York again when everyone's healthy again back over there. But the second book we're starting to write right now, which is very exciting. We are in conversations with, so Ryan Shelton and Laura Waters, the girl who produced all Chris Lee's stuff with him, We Could Be Heroes, etc. We are in conversations about creating a Netflix program. So taking my big public talk to Netflix. So that's really exciting as well. Ryan and I are also looking at now creating with Josh a show, maybe to pitch to the ABC with the two of us. like ABC Kids, just to have his little 5-minute shows between the main shows, just where we introduce this stuff to kids at a very young age. So, a lot happening.
There is a lot happening, and it's been an incredible journey already, but it sounds like it's just getting started in some ways. So, you know, anyone who hasn't read the book, I definitely recommend getting your hands on that, the first book, I guess. So the first book's The Resilience Project, right? So it's really the story of the Resilience Project rather than sort of a manual in gratitude and empathy. It's more telling the story of the Resilience Project. What's the second book all about, Hugh?
That's a good question. I'm flying to Sydney on next Thursday, so we can really try and, I mean, what we're going through right now is, I mean, the first book is, it's, I think the format works, like it's finding happiness through three things: gratitude, empathy, mindfulness. And I know Penguin Random House are pretty keen to try and have finding happiness through three other things, but for me, it's more going to, I would like it to be more about loosely I can give you the themes will be about connection, vulnerability, relationships, shame, but you don't want to have the word shame on the front cover. So it'll be about, it's going to be a lot of the work I've done on myself this year, I suppose, through a very tough year with COVID. Sort of the next, it's also been the next steps for me in like my journey of wellbeing, and the challenges that parenthood have brought me has forced me to be a lot more vulnerable than I've ever been before. I think people think, gosh, you're so vulnerable. He talks about his sister's mental illness, but my sister's well now. So I don't think that takes, that was 10 years ago that she was, or that she was sick. So that was my story 10 years ago. It's more vulnerable talking about what's happening now. So it's going to be a much more vulnerable version of myself, I guess.
Wow. And quite a bit about fatherhood in there as well.
Yeah, I think it'll be every chapter.
Listen, Hugh, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing some of those stories. It's I really admire the work you've done, and it sounds like there's so much more to come. So thanks for making the time, and good luck on your fatherhood journey.
Pleasure. Likewise, Scott, and congratulations on the podcast. I think it's a great conversation to be having, and I think the more dads that listen to this, the better we'll all be.
Thank you. Thank you, Hugh. That was episode 39 of the Dad Train podcast with Hugh Van Kylenberg from The Resilience Project, and what an easy guy he was to have a chat with. If you want to find out more about Hugh and The Resilience Project, I've included links to their website, also to his book and to that podcast, which is called The Imperfects, and that's definitely worth checking out if you haven't had a listen already. He's a great guy, Hugh, and he's doing some amazing work with the Resilience Project, so I really wish them well and all the best for everything that they've got planned. Anyway, that's all for this episode of the Dad Train podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts if you're able to, but also spread the word to other dads. If people want to find out more or check out any of the previous episodes, you can find them all at thedadtrain.com/podcast. Okay, thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Hugh. I'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, good luck on your journey to be a better man, a better partner, and a better dad. I'm Scott Davison, and you've been listening to The Dad Train.